I'm very proud to be the first Speaker of Alaska Native Heritage, and that's something that I hope can serve as a role model.
The legislature's new Speaker of the House reflects a new focus. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 25th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, what to do with the Palmer Correctional Center.
Literally everything is thrown out there. I mean, from medical marijuana to that's where our state capital should be.
That and more on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Just before heading out for the Thanksgiving holiday, the Alaska Division of Elections made its final count Wednesday of outstanding ballots from the November 8th general election. About 700 more absentee and nearly 200 questioned ballots were added to the House District 32 totals, but they did not change the results. Representative Louise Stutes of Kodiak has been reelected. After Wednesday's count, Stutes' lead over unaffiliated challenger Duncan Fields had grown to 210 votes. In Anchorage, incumbent Republican Cherise Millett gained 3 votes above an earlier count. Millett had a 79-vote lead over her Democratic challenger, Pat Higgins. The Millett-Higgins race was the closest of all the races after Wednesday's count. The Division of Elections is targeting next Tuesday for the results to be certified. Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman will be the first Speaker of the Alaska House of Representatives from off the road system or outside of Southeast Alaska since Gnome's Howard Ling in the territorial legislature of 1941. Other rural lawmakers will hold more important leadership posts in the next legislature than they have had in decades. KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what this means.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman and two committee chairmen are from northern or western Alaska. Gnome Democrat Neil Foster will be co-chairman of the House Finance Committee. Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman will be co-chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. It will be the first time both budget writing committees will have chairs from Bush, Alaska since 1990. Hoffman also was a finance chair then, when he served in the House. Edgman says the rural leaders are part of a broader regional balance that will be good for the entire state.
Well, I think it will be good for rural Alaska. And from my standpoint, it's always good to have regional diversity on the finance committees.
Rural lawmakers have a tradition dating back decades of joining majority caucuses. But this session, they're playing a particularly central role in control of the House. Edgman and Foster join with 3 Republicans to switch from the current Republican-led majority to the primarily Democratic incoming majority. What this means for rural residents is uncertain. Rural lawmakers have traditionally argued for maintaining or increasing government services. Service increases will be difficult due to the state's budget crisis. But the incoming House majority is interested in striking a balance that includes both spending cuts and new revenue, like a broad-based income or sales tax, to maintain services. Edgman expects Foster and his Finance Committee co-chair, Paul Seaton, will keep this in mind.
Both individuals, Representative Seaton from Homer, Representative Foster from Nome, are very committed to taking a balanced approach to figuring out the fiscal challenges.
Former University of Alaska Southeast political scientist Clive Thomas notes the state government funds a large share of jobs in rural Alaska, and Thomas expects the rural lawmakers to be at the forefront in defending school funding in particular.
It's a major income generator in most villages, probably the major income generator. So I think that's one of the things that they will be concerned about and want to protect.
Edgman says there's another historic element of the new leadership.
I'm very proud to be the first Speaker of Alaska Native Heritage, and that's something that I hope can serve as a role model for future speakers with Alaska Native blood.
Edgman's a little less than a quarter Aleut, and he also grew up learning Yupik words and phrases in Dillingham, where the two cultures overlap.
I grew up in a small town, So I bring small town values to whatever I do. And I think by nature, I'm somebody who listens first, and I'm not always the biggest talker in the room, and maybe that harkens back to my Alaska Native upbringing.
The budget's effect on rural areas and the rest of the state will be clearer in mid-December when Governor Bill Walker unveils his budget proposal. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Palmer Correctional Center, now shuttered after a State Department of Corrections decision to close it due to budget cuts, was the topic of a brainstorming session earlier this month. The state wants input on how to repurpose the buildings and the land now occupied by the prison. DOC spokesman Corey Allen Young says the session was not a public hearing, but an informal gathering of people with ideas to share.
We gathered key stakeholders from the Mat-Su Valley, Anchorage, representing everybody from state to private faith-based organizations, the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry, Department of Corrections. The whole point of the repurposing brainstorming session was to bring these people together to kind of figure out what's the best use for the repurposing.
The goal, Alan Young says, is to find a way to benefit the community while saving the state some money.
And so one of the things we were asking is what are the kinds of uses best satisfy these interests, and what community interests or concerns should the state be aware of?
DOC contracted with Vantage Consulting as a non-biased third party to organize the event, and Corrections Department personnel only stood by as observers. About 60 people voiced their advice about how best to use the prison facility.
I mean, literally everything is thrown out there. I mean, from medical marijuana to that's where our state capital should be, to fire training. I mean, it was literally we're looking at anything on the table. You know, if it's something that's obviously legal and it's feasible, then we're going to look at it.
The facility covers 640 acres of land owned by the state but leased by DNR, and there are 25 separate buildings on the premises owned by DOC. The prison facility was used to house about 400 inmates, along with workshops used in rehabilitation programs. Top nominations for use of the former prison lean toward either a law enforcement training facility or as a center for opioid addiction programs. DOC is expected to make a decision next year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, could a new presidential administration affect Tongass rules?
There is a new incoming president who disagrees with some of the past administration's regulations and a Congress that is politically aligned with that president.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Residents of the central and eastern Aleutian Islands could see strong winds on Saturday. The National Weather Service has issued a high wind warning for Unalaska and the eastern Aleutians that begins Friday night, that's tonight, and runs to Saturday night. The agency forecasts west winds of 60 to 75 miles an hour with gusts up to 95 miles an hour. Protests on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation continue this week despite rising tensions between protesters and police and dropping temperatures in the Midwest. KCAW's Emily Russell spoke to an organizer of a fundraising event planned for Sitka this weekend, which aims to support the protesters.
My name is Lakota Harden. I'm Minikoju in Yankton, Lakota.
Lakota Hardin's family is from the Lakota Nation in South Dakota, but she spent part of her childhood in Sitka, where she lives now. Since protesting against the Dakota Access Pipeline began this summer, Hardin says it's been difficult to be so far away. Actually, she describes it as turmoil.
Every day I wake up and think, what am I doing here? I need to be down there, especially when I see pictures of my nephews with, you know, rubber bullet wounds.
Hardin did go down in September, but she says work is keeping her in Sitka at the moment. Still, she couldn't sit idly by. A few months ago, she and a few friends helped organize a drum circle downtown.
And we did come together and we sang and prayed because that's what they're asking people to do, first and foremost. And that's what we did. And we had a sign that said Sitka stands with Standing Rock.
The Dakota Access Pipeline would pass under the Missouri River, which the Standing Rock Sioux tribe says threatens its drinking water. That type of message resonates with people in Sitka, Hardin says.
This land, we love this land. We love these waters. You know, we want to protect them. And so people want to make a stand with Standing Rock here.
There's going to be yoga, letter writing, and an art auction. They're also hoping to collect traditional foods to send down to protesters. I'm Emily Russell.
Could President-elect Donald Trump and the incoming Congress change logging plans in southeast Alaska? KSTK's Aaron Bolton reports that changes to the Tongass Forest Plan Amendment, which is a contentious Forest Service regulation, are possible.
The Tongass Land Management Plan Amendment is on its way to being finalized next month. The plan aims to move the southeast timber industry away from logging old-growth forests over the next 16 years. Both environmental and logging industry groups have filed objections to the plan. Environmental groups argue the transition can be made faster, while industry groups want a larger assessment of young growth stocks and to slow the transition. Several objections to the amendment are being evaluated by the U.S. Forest Service. Any changes will be announced later this month. So, when President-elect Trump and a Republican-led Congress begin work in January, could the Tongass Amendment be on the table? Here are some possibilities. Let's start with Congress and the Congressional Review Act, or the CRA.
The Congressional Review Act gives Congress the ability to disapprove federal regulations that have been issued within a certain period of time.
That's Sophie Miller, a senior policy analyst at the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center.
So right now we're looking at federal regulations that have been issued beyond about May 30th, according to the Congressional Research Service. And after Congress disapproves those rules, they would go to the president. And if the president signs that into law, then it would overturn the rule in question, and the agency that issued the rule would not be allowed to issue a rule that was substantially the same.
The CRA has only been successfully used once, during the George W. Bush administration. When Bush came into office, Republicans also controlled Congress.
So we have a similar makeup in the sense that there is a new incoming president who disagrees with some of the past administration's regulations, and with a Congress that is politically aligned with that president, they now have the ability to successfully use the Congressional Review Act.
As to how the CRA can be used, that's a hard question to answer. The Tongass Amendment falls under the 2012 Forest Planning Rule, a result of changes made to a 1982 Forest Service regulation that affects forest planning nationwide. The Bill Clinton, Bush, and Barack Obama administrations all worked to make the rule more flexible for wildlife requirements. The planning rule is out of the CRA's reach, but the amendment could fall under its broad definition.
And one thing that's interesting, too, is that the actions that Congress takes under the CRA are not judicially reviewable. So if they want to expand that bucket somewhat, I'm not sure that there's necessarily a check there to prohibit it.
Also, a CRA bill can't be amended and takes 51 votes in the Senate, not the usual 60. Miller says the CRA is a blunt tool, meaning that Congress wouldn't be able to tell the Forest Service what they would like to see. A new amendment would just have to be different. Miller notes that there are other possible ways Congress can manipulate regulations through funding appropriations and changing what authorities the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service have. As for Trump, who campaigned in the Pacific Northwest on bringing back sawmill jobs, he can't change the Tongass's fate with a stroke of a pen. Tom Waldo, a Juneau staff attorney with Earth Justice, says Trump could direct the Department of Agriculture or the Forest Service to change the amendment if it came onto his radar.
At a minimum, the Forest Service would have to provide public notice of their intent to change the plan and provide an opportunity for members of the public to raise objections or comments or concerns about those changes.
If Trump took a more broad approach and wanted to change the 2012 planning rule, the same idea would apply, and a lengthy process with public comment would begin. Waldo says that depending on the changes, a new environmental impact statement could be needed for either option. He says the topic of the potential changes to the amendment has been on people's minds in Southeast, but all routes to significant change would be long ones. However, the logging industry is still pushing back against the move towards young growth. Owen Graham of the Alaska Forest Association says the logging group is trying to persuade the Forest Service to back away from the amendment.
So we've also reached out to our congressional delegation and asked them to try to legislate either a delay or a complete rescission of this record of decision depending on whether it gets signed or not.
None of the Alaska congressional delegation was able to comment in time for this report. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
World champion skier Keegan Randall is back on the women's U.S. cross-country ski team after taking a season off to have a baby. The announcement of the four-time Olympian's return comes just before the 2016-17 season begins with International Ski Federation World Cup opener taking place Saturday in Ruka, Finland. The 33-year-old Randall has won World Cup titles and two world championship medals. The University of Alaska Anchorage's women's basketball team fell Wednesday to NCAA Division I opponent Missouri State, claiming fourth place in the Great Alaska Shootout. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
UAA head coach Ryan McCarthy shouldered the blame in the Seawolves' 58-65 loss.
I think at the end of the day, this is my fault. You know, we had 21 turnovers, and we weren't focused from that standpoint, and I own that. You know, I think we got to be honest with ourselves and look at what we need to do better in the future if we're going to be talking about championships and things like that, and that starts with me.
The Seawolves took second place in the NCAA Division II National Championships last season. McCarthy said a lack of consistency was his team's biggest flaw.
You know, just once we get the mo, we'd do something to shoot ourselves in the foot. You know, we just couldn't put two and three plays together. You know, we'd make a big play and then have a turnover or not execute a set that we'd worked on a million times.
McCarthy said with senior forward Autumn Williams injured and not in the lineup, UAA was playing shorthanded.
We were coming out limping and we held them off for as long as we could. It's just, you know, they were a little deeper than us.
Two different Seawolves, sophomore guard Tara Thompson and freshman guard Yasmin Gu, played more than 30 minutes on Wednesday, which McCarthy said is a rare occurrence. Thompson and junior forward Shelby Kloninger led UAA in scoring with 15 points each. The Seawolves took fourth place in the tournament behind three Division I opponents. The University of Southern California claimed the women's shootout title, beating Portland in the Great Alaska Shootout Championship. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, tradition as fashion. November is Native American Heritage Month, and to celebrate, we're taking you down the catwalk and into the heart of contemporary Native fashion. From sealskin corsets to gowns fringed like eagle feathers, today's designers are finding new silhouettes for traditional art, and their customers love it. Dodging hairspray and safety pins, KCAW's Emily Kwong went backstage at Sea Alaska's Heritage Institute's Native Fashion Show to talk with two of the sewers on the cutting edge of indigenous design.
Hi, how are you?
Dorothy Grant is in the house. She's one of those women who's always glamorous, dressed in black, eyes bright. Grant is an icon within the Native fashion world. From opera coats to ball gowns, she wants her clothing to instill the person wearing it with self-respect, a Haida principle known as Yungudong.
When I wake up in the morning, I know that I make people feel good in my clothes. No matter where they're going, whether it's a black tie, or they're getting an award, or they're graduating, or they're actually getting married in it.
Or going to the Oscars. In 2015, the ceremony was heavily criticized for a lack of diversity. All the nominees were white. And Dwayne Howard, the First Nations actor who starred in the film The Revenant, didn't get an invitation. He spoke with actor Leonardo DiCaprio, who was also in the film, and locked down an invitation just a week before the ceremony. Grant had little time to build him the tux of his dreams, but as she's done for the past 30 years, she made it work.
You must deliver. You must never not deliver. That's what makes a really good reputation. So even if you have to go in the hole for it, honor your customer.
As far as fashion statements go, the tuxedo speaks volumes. The lapel is adorned with raven and eagle embroidery that catches the light.
Did anyone ask who are you wearing tonight? I know the
Well, the red carpet was 2.5 hours long, and he got a lot of questions about the tuxedo.
In her blog, Grant wrote that during the third fitting, they both cried. I realized, she wrote, it was about us all, about the native youth who would see him, the ones having self-image issues, the ones feeling like giving up. It was like a long journey we both came to at once, like reaching a mountaintop.
I'm so nervous because it's so gorgeous.
Tonight, the suit will be worn by Conrad Frank. The makeup artist furiously pounds his nose with powder while I point the microphone at his chin. Though Frank isn't a real model by training, when I ask him how he's going to walk, he says, carefully, he does plan to stand tall.
I work all over the place in totem poles. House screens, designs. It's nice to see it on a different level.
The fashion show is underway, and every seat in the Cedar Clan house of the Walter Soboloff building is full. It's tuxedo time.
The men's tuxedo modeled by Conrad Frank.
Frank steps into the spotlight. Though he looks a bit nervous, he gains his footing as he walks. And when he hits the mark, he stands nice and tall, just as Grant hoped he would.
You were so sweet. Everybody loved it.
Thanks for letting me wear the suit.
The show's over. I'm backstage with designer and model. Grant tucks the tuxedo back into the garment bag. While this piece is one of a kind, she has something similar listed on her online retail store for $2,100. Because for a designer, just as important as making work is selling it.
These are gorgeous.
One of the new designers finding retail success is Heather Dixon. We're at the Northwest Coast Art Market, the day after the fashion show. Dixon has covered the drab plastic table with a bright floral cloth. Stacked upon it is her signature product, granny hanky headbands.
Well, growing up in the North, a lot of First Nation elders wore these beautiful colored hankies, and I'd try and wear it, and it wouldn't stay on, it would slip off, so I decided to cut it up and make my own headband.
She made another for her friend, but added ornate beadwork to the fabric.
She posted a selfie after I sent it to her, and it just blew up.
A year later, Dixon has a booming online business. At one North American market, she sold out in 4 minutes. Some customers are drawn to Dixon's table because of the beautiful beadwork and all the colors. But others, like Elizabeth Childs from Massachusetts, knows Dixon's work already.
I want one so bad. I have a really big head, though, so should I be looking in this bin?
I have a measuring tape here.
Dixon is a pro and a hard worker. At her kitchen table in Whitehorse, she sometimes sews until 2 a.m. Childs picks up a headband with buttons, an homage to the borders of button blankets.
I'm a professional clown, and my clown name is Buttons.
That's so awesome.
I do like face painting and balloons. Okay, maybe this one is the one. Let's try it on.
And it's a hit. Dixon takes her cash. The sun is setting. We start talking about Dorothy Grant, who's a big inspiration for her. And what she appreciates most is this.
Well, I think she kind of paved the way for people viewing West Coast art as being really elegant and formal and feeling like royalty when you wear it.
Which is kind of fitting as we watch her newest customer walk away with a headband fit for a queen. For AK, I'm Emily Kwong.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute hosted this fashion show during a 4-day dance and culture festival. To see pictures from the night, visit our website, alaskapublic.org. And now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Mao Tosi in Anchorage. Tosi is a property manager at the Northway Mall and a community advocate.
When we first moved here, we ended up going to moving into a family's house in Eagle River, and we stayed there for about a month, and that was my first experience around just white people. It was very uncomfortable for me and my older brother that at Gruny Middle School, when it was lunchtime, we would actually, I would just go sit in the bathroom stall. And it was funny, one time I went and sat in there that I realized my brother was right next to me. And so it's just how uncomfortable we felt. We ended up moving into Mountain View right after that. And it almost seemed like we moved back into San Diego. Mountain View is the most diverse neighborhood in the country, and one of the best things about this diversity and us being all different is to try to find the commonalities that we have. Maybe your kid now is on the basketball team with my kid, so there are always interests that can bring us together. There's always something. The further away from Anchorage we go, the less diverse we are, and if that is so, then it's very important that I always take teams of diversity into rural communities, into the valley, into all of Alaska to show them what we look like. But if this is their first experience with a Sudanese, a Samoan, a Hmong, then let it be the best one. Because if this is the only hour they get to see us, then if it is a very good one, then they're open to the next experience. Not every Polynesian, not every Samoan is going to be an NFL player. I would like to see more judges and doctors that are Polynesian, that are Sudanese, that are Black, that are of our community, you know, so that hopefully if they succeed, they don't forget where they came from and can come back and do what they can.
Mao Tosi lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Kwong and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, or you can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, Emily Russell in Sitka, and Josh Edge in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.